consequences of COVID for rural hospitals is way different than for urban hospitals. There are a lot of these rural hospitals that end up like closing because of COVID. They are the hospitals that are essentially also the large employers in those rural communities. So a lot of people also lost their jobs, lost their work, lost their only income. For me, COVID gave us the ability to think about all of this more proactively.
To improve healthcare in America, we need two things. We need aspiration and we need evidence. I think we have a lot of the aspiration. And what Sarush is saying is we don't have the evidence. So let's not lose the aspiration we have. I think embedded in the Inflation Reduction Act is well-intentioned aspiration that we want to reduce the price of a variety of drugs. We don't use the best evidence to figure out how to do that.
Welcome to the Harvard Kennedy School PolicyCast. I'm your host, Ralph Ranelli. The COVID-19 pandemic has stretched the US healthcare system and healthcare systems across the world to the breaking point and beyond. If there's a silver lining, it may be that there is now the urgency and the will among politicians and policymakers to pursue meaningful changes that could result in improved access to healthcare that's both more affordable and higher quality. A recent example in the US were the healthcare provisions in the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act, which were hailed as a breakthrough for, at a minimum, finally breaking the pharmaceutical industry's stranglehold on attempts to control prescription drug prices. But as healthcare policy enters what is widely seen as an inflection point, Harvard Kennedy School professors Amitabh Chandra and Sarush Sagafian say even well-intentioned, quick-fix policy changes may end up doing more harm than good. Instead, they say policymakers need to pursue change with care by deeply analyzing the weaknesses COVID exposed and using that data to design intelligent policy that can create truly transformational change. Professor Chandra is the Director of Health Policy Research at the Kennedy School, and his research focuses on innovation and pricing in the biopharmaceutical industry and value and racial disparities in healthcare delivery. Professor Sagafian is the founder of the Public Impact Analytics Science Lab at Harvard, and his work combines big data analytics, health policy, and decision science to uncover new insights and find new solutions to existing problems. They're here today to talk through this important historic moment in healthcare policy, both in terms of the challenges and the opportunities. So, Sarush, Amitabh, welcome to PolicyCast.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thrilled to be here.
So we've had a couple of major events over the last couple of years that have affected healthcare. The first that I'm thinking about was the COVID-19 pandemic, obviously a huge one, which in a number of ways stretched the US healthcare system and healthcare systems across the world to their breaking points and sometimes beyond. And we've recently had the passage in the US also of the Inflation Reduction Act, which included some seemingly significant affordability provisions for both prescription drugs and health coverage. So it seems to me that we're at an interesting inflection point for healthcare, especially in the United States. Would you agree with that? And how would you characterize, just to start, the current moment for healthcare policy? Maybe Amitabh, I'll let you tackle that one first.
That's a great question. I think the key takeaway for me is that the COVID pandemic certainly accelerated a variety of trends that we had already been seeing. So we had already started to use telehealth, and we have really accelerated the use of something like telehealth. We had already started to bet on mRNA vaccines before COVID, but COVID might allow us to achieve their full potential. I feel very differently about the Inflation Reduction Act. I really don't think that it is nearly of the same magnitude as the COVID epidemic. It's actually tiny. I mean, it is called the Inflation Reduction Act because we're in a period of high inflation. It's called the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, but it's really going to do nothing in 2022 or 2023 or 2024. And if you look at how much the Inflation Reduction Act will really reduce our deficit, it's going to reduce our deficit by about $20 billion over the next 5 years. And that is tiny. That is tiny. In over 10 years, it'll reduce the deficit by about $300 billion, which sounds like a lot of money because it is to all of us. But in the context of the balance sheet of the United States government, we're talking about undetectable differences. So there's a colossal amount of overselling of the Inflation Reduction Act, which is different than saying it's a bad act. We'll probably spend some time talking about all the good ideas in it. But it's a tiny piece of legislation relative to the enormous dent that COVID-19 has put into the health of the economy and the health of all Americans.
Well, I think people are saying about the Inflation Reduction Act, if you look at sort of the optimistic takes on it, that it may be a tiny step, but it's a tiny step in a space where we were getting no steps at all. And that particularly in the area of controlling prescription drug costs in the United States, it was kind of a seen as, you know, breaking the grip ever so slightly of big pharma in terms of drug pricing. I mean, do you take any positives away from just the spirit of it?
It is true that it's the first time that pharma, the trade association pharma, and bio, the other trade association, have actually lost. So in that sense of, is there some significance to Congress passing legislation that hurts the revenues of the pharmaceutical industry? Is that salient? Absolutely. But that's quite different than saying, we have taken a big piece out of the industry. And so let me just explain and put all of this into context. If you think about how much money we will save as a result of the Act's provisions in the drug pricing part of the Act, over 10 years we'll save, if you're optimistic, about $300 billion. That's about $30 billion a year. And just to be clear, those savings won't kick in for many years, but let's just assume that over the, let's just be optimistic and say they'll kick in right away, which just to be clear, the Act doesn't, it's not written that way, but we're going to be saving about $30 billion a year. That sounds like a lot of money, but look, annual spending on drugs is about $450 billion a year. So this is less than 10%. And then the question becomes, is this the right way to even do it? So there's a variety of drugs where the government is appropriately worried about their high price. But what you see in the Inflation Reduction Act is an extremely arbitrary way at getting at solutions to reduce the price. The idea here in the Act is, let's pick 10 medicines in 2026 and negotiate the price of 10. Let me assure you that we're having problems with many more than 10 medicines. And then when we get up to 2029, when the full act takes place, you know, we're talking about negotiating the price of 20 medicines. So we're talking about 10 and 20 medicines. Well, we know that there are thousands of medicines out there. So again, you know, is that really the right way to go about doing it? And then is this really even negotiation? Because as you know, the way the act works, if a manufacturer does not give the government the price that the government wants, then the government is able to put a colossal excise tax on the manufacturer. Is that really negotiation? So the tax is colloquially described as being somewhere between 65% of total sales for drugs, all the way up to 95% of sales. So is that really negotiation, right? That's something we really have to grapple with. I think We call this negotiation, but is it really negotiation if I walk up to you or my friend Sarooj and say, Sarooj, I'm going to beat you up if you don't hand me your wallet. And then Sarooj hands me his wallet. Is that really negotiation?
Right.
Other countries don't negotiate in this manner. Negotiation means you offer a price, and if you don't get the price, you don't get the drug. You don't get to then use the full taxing authority of the United States government to get the price that you want. And if you start to do things like that, it will affect the pharmaceutical companies' incentives to be in the pharmaceutical business.
Maybe I wanted to just add a little bit of perspective to this, Ralph, is that I think it will help if we just to step back a little bit and think about, you know, the healthcare sector for a little bit. So we are spending about $4 trillion, right? So that's 20% of our GDP. That's about if you think about it per capita, it's about 2.5 times, you know, average of other OECD countries. And at the same time, you know, the latest sort of rankings show that, like, we are, in terms of life expectancy as at birth, let's say, we are 31st. You look at the maternal mortality or infant mortality, you look at the obesity rate, you look at the heart disease, you know, rates, you look at HIV, diabetes. Across all these, you know, outcomes, we are not doing well. Now, prices are obviously, you know, one part of the problem, but it's a very small part of the whole picture to me. There are three things in the act that I think are trying to, you know, sort of get to the expenditure. One is that, well, you know, obviously we'll give more power to Medicare to, you know, negotiate Part D and Part B drugs. The other thing is that, well, you know, it will expand some eligibility for low-income Part D subsidies. So for instance, you know, it was 135%. Now they're saying, okay, we are going to move it to 150% of the federal poverty limit. And the other part of the act that I think is effective is putting a cap on the expanding. But all of this altogether, if successful, over 10 years, we are thinking about, you know, the latest estimate is about $287 billion, or if you're optimistic, as Amitabh said, let's say $300 billion over 10 years. That is not much. And, you know, to get to the main issues of the healthcare, to me, we have to think more about how to be efficient and effective, not just, you know, reducing prices. Obviously, it's important to do that, but it doesn't get us to where we want to be in a big picture in terms of the healthcare.
Right. And I'm glad you said that, because I did want to return to that big picture. Sarush, in February, you looked at pandemic-related hospital closures and the changes they're causing and what information came out of that that could be useful for policymakers. But you also said there were unique opportunities for researchers to conduct studies that can shed light on what you call different implications, trade-offs, and consequences of various strategies that can be followed. So going back to COVID, turning away, I guess, from the IRA for a minute, what do you see in the big picture as the opportunities created for research that informs policy coming out of the pandemic?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So first of all, I think COVID was a very serious stress test for hospitals. So we learned whether, you know, the hospitals can be flexible enough to essentially, you know, handle demand shocks like COVID. Are they flexible enough to shift their resources from, you know, elective surgeries, for instance, to something that is more urgent? These are sort of, if you think about this as in supply chains, you know, we think of them as disruption risks. And, you know, we try to stress test supply chains. But in hospitals, we haven't done much of this. And so this was a serious, you know, sort of test for us to see whether the healthcare systems, the providers are, you know, able to handle demand shocks. The second thing was the government tried to now support hospitals that are really in bad situation, because as you may know, a lot of hospitals had to like stop their elective surgeries and, you know, try to handle more of the COVID patients, which, you know, in terms of their profit, there are the margin is really low for hospitals. So it put a really heavy financial stress also, not just operational stress, but also financial stress over hospitals. The government then tried to introduce this CARES Act, which was Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, which gave $175 billion to healthcare providers that are, you know, dealing with all the financial consequences of coronavirus and other things. Now, what is important here is that we have to learn how to use money like that, how to use our limited resources more efficiently. That is that how do we allocate this to hospitals and to different, you know, providers? The consequences of COVID for, you know, let's say rural hospitals is way different than for urban hospitals. A lot of these rural hospitals that end up like closing because of COVID, they are the hospitals that are essentially also the large employers in those rural communities. So a lot of people also lost their jobs, lost their work, lost their only income. So I think for me, COVID gave us the ability to think about all of this more proactively. And the last piece is about how do we support, you know, R&D activities of vaccine providers, of other organizations that are trying to, for instance, now use AI methods and other methods to predict the next pandemic and to allow us to alleviate it by either developing, you know, related vaccines in advance or by trying to just have some alarm systems when these things come up. I got a call in February from the government of Bahrain. They asked us to, you know, analyze some data because they thought there is going to be a pandemic. This is before WHO announced the pandemic. So there are signs and there are technologies now that we can use to be ready for the next pandemic. And I think that's very important for us to put all these lessons together and try to make sure that the next pandemic is not going to, you know, change everybody's life as COVID.
That's such a great point. Can I jump in? And
absolutely.
And I'm listening to Sarush, realize that it is so easy to criticize various parts of the COVID response. You know, we were definitely underprepared for it. That said, we know that these pandemics will happen again. Even before COVID, there was SARS, there was MERS, there was H1N1, there was Ebola. So that, you know, pandemics have affected other parts of the world. They've not really shown up on our shores since the influenza pandemic over 100 years ago. So we should be prepared for the next pandemic. And one way to prepare for the next pandemic is to learn what we did well and what we did badly in this pandemic. So Sarush mentioned the $187 billion that the federal government allocated to providers, hospitals, and doctors. Well, that was an extraordinary piece of legislation because Congress was able to work together during the pandemic to pass the legislation. Now, what we failed on, though, was we failed in figuring out who should get the money. And if you look at who should get the money, one of the things that we found was that the money went to extremely well-resourced hospitals, not the ones that Sarush is worried about and not the ones that Congress is worried about and not the minority serving hospitals and doctors. The money disproportionately went to wealthy hospitals in Boston and wealthy hospitals in Los Angeles. So the lesson is, let's compliment Congress for the CARES Act and the speed of the CARES Act. But the next time something like this happens, pandemic or catastrophe, let's be sure that the formulas we're using to determine the allocation are not as biased, not as blunt. It's not that we sent the money out even randomly this time. We sent the money to wealthy places. That was easily avoidable. I think the other point that Sarush is making, which is something that I don't see a lot of discussion around, is that the elective surgeries that got delayed, some of them never came back. Hospitals have closed in rural areas. Some physicians have retired. Many nurses have retired. What do we do about the fact that there was a 70% decline in mammograms, a 70% decline in colonoscopies? The consequences of those delayed diagnoses will reverberate for years to come. And we have to. This is the moment to think about how to bring all of those people into the system. Because the next time there's a pandemic, even if we allocate the money properly, there will be many preventable cases of non-communicable disease. I'm talking about heart attacks and cancer, and I'm not talking about COVID. So I think that the issues that Sarush raises are incredibly complex, incredibly rich. And connecting COVID to the Inflation Reduction Act, it's not like the Inflation Reduction Act takes on these really big challenges.
Right. So it seems to me that where the Inflation Reduction Act discussion that we've had so far and the COVID response criticisms that we've explored so far, where they intersect is sort of a disconnect between good intentions and good policy, right? We want to put money somewhere. We have to solve a problem. But in the middle, we've got bad policy that's making things in some cases worse, but definitely not as good as they could be. How do we get to those good policies using what we've learned? And how do we get them adopted in a way that's helpful and meaningful?
I can answer that question. So based on some sort of research that we did. So let's think about what Amitabh mentioned about, you know, hospitals closing. And I agree with all the great points Amitabh is bringing up. So let's first think about what happens when a hospital closes, right? So, you know, the surrounding hospitals now, you know, have to handle the patients that used to go to those hospitals, right? So now, what do those hospitals do? So there's a lot of discussion by policymakers about, okay, so these hospitals that close, you know, they are not efficient. So let them close. So we only will have efficient hospitals and efficient providers remaining, right? So we did a research to see whether that's that's correct or not. So it turns out that what hospitals, the surrounding hospitals, remaining hospitals do. Do they become more efficient or not? So at some level, we find that they become more efficient because with their current resources, with their current number of beds, providers, etc., they are serving more patients. So per resource, essentially, they are serving more patients, right? So from that perspective, you can argue that, yeah, it's good for the efficiency of the system. It's good to let those hospitals close. But it turns out that what they do is that they are not essentially improving their efficiency by, for instance, increasing their bed utilization, right? So what they do is that they just speed up the care. And speeding up the care can be a good thing or can be a bad thing. If you're, you know, removing some of the extra steps that are redundant, you know, extra tests that we know some providers do, extra, like, you know, not value added essentially steps, that's a good thing. But what we find is that they are cutting some value added steps for most of the patients. And if you look at, you know, the impact on things like mortality or readmission rate and things like that, we are seeing that there's an increase. So now policymakers have to think about these things, that if you're allocating money to prevent hospitals from closing, you know, they've been thinking about access to care, but that's only one dimension. This policy, as Amitabh mentioned, these policy questions are extremely complex, right? You have to think about various dimensions of that. So one dimension is access, that they think about, okay, so if a rural hospital closes, you know, people lose their access. But there are other things. There's, you know, quality implications. There are, you know, implications in terms of, like, outcomes that we need to think about. And we've had policies to, like, you know, help rural hospitals from closures and things like that. And if we want to summarize them, none of them have been working, essentially, right? So what it tells us is that we still don't know how to allocate money, how to allocate limited resources. And to me, if you want to make the healthcare system more efficient, well, what does efficiency mean? It means that you're using your limited resources more intelligently, right? So you have to learn how to allocate those limited resources intelligently. And I think we need more research and more thinking rather than, you know, thinking about this allocations of money and, you know, other policies that we've had as sort of immediate sort of thinking of, like, you know, we need the money, let's pass this legislation and let's allocate the money. That then what happens is what Amitabh is saying is that, you know, MGH of the words, Mayo Clinics of the words, they get the money. And the hospitals that would remain and would be efficient, you know, they don't get the money, right? So to me, we need more thinking and more research in this area.
Amitabh, how do we get to that place where good policy research is informing these decisions in a much more robust way?
To improve healthcare in America, we need two things. We need aspiration and we need evidence. I think we have a lot of the aspiration. And what Sarush is saying is we don't have the evidence. So let's not lose the aspiration we have. I think embedded in the Inflation Reduction Act is well-intentioned aspiration that we want to reduce the price of a variety of drugs. We don't use the best evidence to figure out how to do that. And we let Congress figure these issues out at moments of incredible urgency. So we're taking on prescription drug prices and calling it the Inflation Reduction Act because inflation is high right now, right? Prescription drug prices being high is probably an issue that has affected Americans for a long time. It doesn't have to do with this current spike in gasoline prices. So passing major pieces of legislation at the wrong time doesn't seem like a good recipe. But I think that a lot of the pieces to get the right legislation are already in place in the United States. I'm a big believer in the work of the technocratic agencies, for example. I'm thinking here of agencies like the Congressional Budget Office, which scores the Inflation Reduction Act and had bad news for Congress. It said, you know, you think you're saving all this money. You think you're going to cure us of inflation. You're not, because at the end of the day, you're going to save about $290 billion over 10 years. That's not going to do anything to the deficit. And most of the savings come many years from now. Take another technocratic agency like the FTC. The FTC has been very worried about hospitals consolidating, in part because they're running out of cash, or they say they're running out of cash, because one of the things we know from our colleague Limor Daphne's work is when hospitals merge, they often raise price, and some might actually lower quality as well. So the FTC has been acutely aware of that phenomenon. And that's a good thing, because they prevent maybe hospitals from merging and raise prices. Another technocratic agency that really did extremely well during COVID was the FDA. I think the FDA's emergency approval pathways, the partnerships that it forged with vaccine manufacturers, is exactly the template, not only for the next pandemic, but for the approval of all drugs. Often, I think FDA scientists know a lot more about the sorts of worries that you might have about an untested medical technology than physicians or patients might have. So I think three technocratic agencies certainly give us, or give me, an enormous sense of optimism. And so relying on Congress's aspirations paired with these technocratic agencies is the right formula for taking on the very big challenges ahead of us.
Now, Sarush, in terms of finding evidence, you're affiliated with, among others, Harvard's centers that study health policy, but also decision science and data analytics. You teach big data and machine learning. How do those areas come together to provide useful insight into real-world healthcare?
So one of the big issues, as Amitabh pointed, in sort of improving the healthcare sector is to use evidence, right? And that's where I think use of data and use of technology, you know, we have ignored that. And there are enormous opportunities that we are thinking of for the future of healthcare. You know, for instance, we are now working on projects related to, and a lot of other researchers are doing that as well, using this AI, you know, AI technologies that are, you know, trained over data sets. And now we are putting them on mobile apps, and we are trying to prevent patients from going to the hospitals because their phone can be their doctors. You know, if you think about the traditional ways of, and a lot of, like, unfortunately, like, our policies are designed for the traditional healthcare system where, you know, the care, delivery of care is bounded by the physician and the patient being at the same location, being either the hospital or the office of the physician or things like that, right? With the new technologies now, with the algorithms, with the cell phones, wearables, etc., we don't have to have the patient and the physician provider be at the same location. You know, the cell phone can be now the provider, right? So we need to use more evidence of how do we train these algorithms correctly. And that's what part of the things we are doing in my lab is trying to train these algorithms correctly over large amounts of data so that they intervene correctly. They prevent patients from needing to go to the hospitals. I mentioned, you know, that the COVID did a stress test on hospitals, right? You know, so their beds were full, and so they couldn't handle the demand. Now, maybe if their cell phones were their providers, we could prevent them from going to the hospitals, right?
Right. And didn't COVID sort of act, I know this is probably the worst analogy, but almost as an icebreaker?
Absolutely.
To retraining people that they didn't necessarily have to go physically to see their doctor, but they could have a telehealth appointment and still feel comfortable that they were getting good healthcare.
Absolutely. And Amita pointed to this that, you know, we were thinking about telehealth before COVID. There were regulations that prevented them from like being under mass use. Policymakers then decided, you know, we have to remove these things because we cannot work with those restrictive policies anymore that restricts telehealth, for instance, right? And I think, you know, again, going back to the point that a lot of this policies and regulations have been designed for the traditional healthcare system. The COVID, I think one of the silver lining thing was that it allowed us to rethink these things and try to, you know, think about the future of the healthcare systems in a little bit more proactive way.
I think where that takes us, Sarush, is that if you think of a technology like telemedicine being a substitute for an inpatient encounter, when I think about all the delayed cancer diagnosis that happened, I think, wow, doesn't that mean that we as a nation should be investing much more in at-home testing for cancer? So I know there's a very active debate between a company called Cologuard, which allows you to do, you know, it's a substitute for going to the physician's office for a colonoscopy. And I think a lot of physicians would say it's not a substitute for an actual colonoscopy. Maybe it isn't, right? So I'm not here to take a position on that. But isn't the point that that kind of innovation, if we made it better, would be a way to get people access in ways that reduce the dependence on the office visit, which may be better than the at-home test, but adherence with the office visit is going to be exactly zero if there's a pandemic, or if you are a poor person who can't get to the doctor's office. So there's many reasons to think that better medical innovation, not only in the sense of diagnostics, but also in the sense of treatment, is where we want to be. The Inflation Reduction Act, for example, reduces the out-of-pocket on insulin to $35 a month. I think that's a wonderful thing. I think it's an absolutely wonderful thing, but it does make me ask two questions. First, why is it even $35 a month? I mean, who's overusing their insulin, just to be clear? You know, which insulin patient is like, well, I, you know, because I faced the $35 a month, I use my insulin optimally. So, you know, it sort of highlights how terrible even the thinking around this well-intentioned idea was. Second, what about all the other medicines that patients need where the out-of-pocket is incredibly high for them? But third, why are we still treating diabetes with insulin? Why have we not figured out how to cure insulin, literally cure it, not just treat it? You know, what would it take for our scientists at Harvard and around the world to think about ideas from regenerative medicine to create beta cells in the pancreas that actually secrete insulin so that a diabetic would go in for a procedure and in some ideal world or in some future world, we'll just never have diabetes again. That is where we want to be, because it's only then that we have really reduced disease. And to your point, Sarush, it's only then that we've reduced a lot of these disparities, a lot of these wedges that actually affect the less privileged a lot more than the more privileged.
I wanted to also add the other aspect of this, which is malpractices, for instance, in the hospitals and other providers. If you want to improve the healthcare system, large part of the costs are coming from malpractices. It, you know, hurts patients, it hurts providers. You know, you think about the number of lawsuits that physicians are going through. Think about how many patients die because of malpractices and things like that. Well, guess what? We have AI now. We have, you know, large amount of data. We have ability to train all these algorithms over large. We have IBM Watson, which was sold to a private equity company recently. But we have the ability to use all this technology to remove malpractices. But also, to Amitabh's point, you know, improve drug development, find cures, right? So now a lot of these companies are realizing that, well, AI is enabling us to speed up drug development, find new cures for diabetes and other diseases, right? So we have to, I think, you know, from a policy perspective, I think it's important for policymakers to think about those things. When we talk about, you know, efficiency being intelligent allocation of resources, right? Why are we, like, you know, putting all of our efforts to reduce prices? but not thinking about this other important aspects.
Well, I wanted to wrap up by just asking you both, with all this learning that we've done over the pandemic and all the tools that are available to us now, what is your hope, your best case scenario for what we can achieve in terms of making a healthcare system that works better than the one we have now? Sarush, maybe you want to take this first?
Yeah, sure. So I think part of it for me is to being more optimistic about using technology. We have now projects that are trying to focus on using AI for predicting new pandemic and things like that. We have to think more carefully about how technology can help the healthcare sector, how the private companies that are developing all these technologies can help the policy aspects of things and can integrate things. And for me, I think, you know, these technologies that, for instance, Amitabh mentioned, that allow us to find better solutions for diabetes, trying to, you know, move patients out of hospitals. Many researchers are now working on home health, which means that the hospital is going to be at your home. You don't need to go to the hospitals, you know, that's the traditional way. So I think for me, one is about sort of moving from traditional systems to more innovative ways of delivering care. The second part for me is about, you know, using data to improve the quality of care. And we haven't done much about that, you know. So for instance, the Trump administration started doing transparency on prices, right? So they said, okay, all the hospitals and providers have to announce their prices. Nothing on the quality side yet. We've had a lot of papers published on public reporting of hospital outcomes of the quality of care, but we haven't done much about it, right? So how do we improve the quality that is deliver to the patients using technology, using evidence and data? And to me, those can help. And I'm also very optimistic about moving towards value-based payments. So the traditional, again, ways of delivering care are, in the US, have been all about volume-based. The more patients you serve, the more profit you generate, the more incentives you have. The push to value-based health delivery, to me, hasn't gone that much. There are issues, obviously negative things about it that needs to be resolved. But at the end of the day, we have to think about, if we want to have an innovative system, how do we move from this old volume-based delivery to value-based delivery?
Amitabh, I'll let you have the last word.
I agree with everything Sarush said. So if I can just add to what he said, I want us as a country to grapple with two challenges. The first is long-term care. We discussed it in a very short way when we were trying to pass the Affordable Care Act, but it got taken out. But the reality is that we have millions of Americans who, as they age, are suffering from Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, other forms of dementia, other mobility problems. They don't need hospital care. They don't need to go to the doctor, but they need long-term care. And the United States does not offer a long-term care benefit. Medicare does not offer a long-term benefit. And the United States has really not grappled with the colossal cost of that long-term care benefit. And because it's going to be expensive, we say we don't want to do it. But I think that's a very cruel solution. And I think it also impedes exactly the kind of innovation that Sarush wants us to engage with. The second thing that I would encourage is more innovation, not just for the diseases where we have innovation, but the diseases where we have no innovation. So go back to Alzheimer's, for example. We don't have a meaningful disease-altering drug for Alzheimer's, and one is still likely to be several years or decades away. And so one thing that I've learned from COVID is that relatively small amounts of money can actually induce massive amounts of innovation. That was my big takeaway from COVID. I mean, if you go back to Operation Warp Speed, the government said, you know, here's about $13 billion that we will give manufacturers who are successful, who successfully develop COVID vaccines. And we had something like 5 to 10 manufacturers jump into that race, and we got many successful vaccines out of it. And that was people chasing a $10 to $13 billion prize. Now, what if we use that kind of thinking to announce similar prizes? And I realize the government didn't call it a prize, but it was functionally a prize because you only were able to tap into the money if you developed a successful vaccine. What if we said we're going to use that kind of thinking to create, you know, other vaccines for other diseases? Maybe it's hepatitis B, you know, maybe it's river blindness, maybe it's medicines that delay cognitive decline and dementia. It might not take a lot of money to create a transformational change in the amount of suffering that patients have right now. But that will require us to spend more, not less. So that's something that we have to come to terms with, is that if the extra spending was worth it, then we should absolutely be doing it.
Well, let's hope some of these great policy ideas actually are able to make a difference. I want to thank you both for being here. It's been enjoyable and an education, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you for a great conversation.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Please join us for our next episode when we'll welcome Harvard Kennedy School Professor Daniel Schneider for a discussion about the SHIFT Project and his research on the ripple effects that insecure employment and unpredictable scheduling have on workers and the broader economy. If you have a suggestion for a future show or a question, please email us at policycast@hks.harvard.edu. And until next time, remember to speak bravely and listen generously.